As you listen today, I am in Montego Bay, Jamaica, at the home of our great friends George and Ann Beasley. They've been kind enough to invite my Ann and me to their Jamaican home every year for the past 30 years, sometimes twice a year. The four of us have traveled together all over the world for more than 40 years. It's a particularly strong relationship that we treasure. I'll give you the comments that I promised about Mars a few weeks ago. But first, I've spoken about how divided our country has become and the danger that presents to us. Races pitted against races, rich against poor, young against the old. The emphasis today is increasingly pitting men and women against each other. Now, I spend many hours every day researching the topics I bring to you each week in my commentaries. I utilize many sources to blend with my own thoughts, and today's commentary was aided by RedState.com. I speak of the Democrat war on white men. There is one reason that Barack Hussein Obama won the presidency and secured the votes of whites to win it. He promised to heal race relations in America. For white people, healing race relations is code for ending affirmative action, or AA. Obama knew that, and that's why he said it. Affirmative action policy is a scourge that has divided Americans since its inception. But Democrats knew that whites would resist a policy that purposely placed them at the back of the line and gave opportunities to people who were not qualified, not experienced, or credentialed for those opportunities, regardless of the compassion stated. To enforce a policy like AA, harsh punishments were needed. Democrats set upon a path to make the word racist akin to serial killer or child rapist. They needed a club like racist to cow politicians and the public. While there are many Democratic men, the Democrat Party still hates white men. They have worked to create policies to punish them since the 1960s. There is a reason for it. It's payback for rejecting the bizarro Democrat policies and favoring personal responsibility. Bribing votes is one way Democrats can retain power. The other way is to throw open the border and allow a migration of foreigners to swoop in. Once Democrat policies lost support of the mainstream, Democrats were forced to gather votes from segments of our society that were once taboo. Homosexuals, atheists, and others like eco-ideologies who reject religion, replacing it with a political cause. Democrats were challenged to alter societal norms, to incorporate these once taboo groups into the larger society. Forcing society to accept the once taboo behaviors was a challenge that only the power of the federal government could accomplish. Democrats have a zero-sum mentality. For one group to gain, another group must suffer. White men were Democrats' loudest critics. They refused to accept the Democrat experimentation, and most stopped voting for Democrats. That came to a head in the mid-1960s, shortly after the Madeline Murray O'Hare decision that removed school prayer. Civil rights laws were enacted. The birth control pill came of age, enabling women to control pregnancies and potentially work full-time. The political turmoil of the 60s drove average ordinary Americans to seek tradition and stability away from the Democrat Party. The convention in 1968 was a watermark. That was when radicals demonstrated and rioted, those same people that now head the Democrat Party. Additionally, Democrats knew their opposition to civil rights did not bode well. They adopted a new political idiom to directly purchase the votes of their new constituents and, hopefully, lure others with handouts. Affirmative action laws were one of a set of new handouts Democrats created to buy votes and punish their critics. These Democrat policies were presented as long overdue, fair, only offering a leg up for minorities, deprived of endemic inequality and opportunity. Democrats promised no quotas would arise. Senate Majority Leader Democrat Hubert Humphrey said he would eat the bill if quotas ever arose. They did arise, but Humphrey never ate them. Democrats used these policies to buy votes of diverse dependents groups. Affirmative action policies gave out jobs, promotions, and other opportunities to sanctioned Democrat groups, whether they qualified for the jobs or not. If the groups hired could not perform the jobs as historically constructed, the requirements were dumbed down and/or the physical requirements were alleviated. If, after those changes, the new hire remained incapable of performing the job, more people were hired to paper over the missing skills and abilities. Democrats were fine with that, as it assured more votes. Racial and sexual quotas precluded white men from consideration of those opportunities. When legitimate complaints were raised and the sanctioned minorities shown unable to perform, a re-evaluation of the policies was not forthcoming. Judicial activism and more strident policies were issued to punish anybody with the temerity to challenge those policies. The term racist became the ubiquitous label affixed to those who bucked the AA system. The racist label is like a tattoo. It can't be removed and results in the wearer being punished and mocked for the remainder of their lives. Most lost their livelihoods, opportunities for promotion, or access to any opportunity where government dollars were being invested. Over time, after losing specious lawsuits and other government incentives, IRS audits, EEOC investigations, and such, businesses fell in line and changed their operations to comply with affirmative action mandates. White men were the original focus and remained the focus of AA policymaking. These policies were not created to be helpful to minorities. The purpose was to buy votes. Democrats have been very successful in these ambitions, using the power of the federal, then state, then local governments to label troublemakers as racists. With no good-paying jobs or association within those jobs, white men lost influence. They could not afford to contribute to political campaigns, and the mere mention of changing the AA laws was suicide. White men then were politically neutered and forgotten about. Democrats believed that policy changes had permanently changed society to enable them to illegally buy votes. This practice is fundamentally bribery, and it is the Democrats' means of gaining political power. However, Democrats must constantly rearrange the deck furniture on this titanic monstrosity. There is competition for the money they hand out. There are other issues. Democrats must make accepting government handouts somehow acceptable. They must make households where wives are primary breadwinners acceptable. Democrats created boogeymen and villains to blame for the failures of their dependents, and those boogeymen became rich white men. Democrats worked to install tax policies that steal the wealth of these men and give it to Democrat dependents, making this theft and bribery not only acceptable, but the fair and proper thing to do is job number one for Democrats. The problem with that, there are many, but the main one is that this practice is unsustainable. The rich do not own enough wealth to bribe everyone Democrats need to retain power. Eventually, white men pretty much stopped voting. Nobody would stand up for their constitutionally ordered civil rights. They were disenfranchised. Democrats had successfully dispirited white men to think both parties were the same. Republicans were silenced with threats of racism. Neither party would mention this inequality. Championing the civil rights of white men, their constitutionally ordered rights, was out of the question. That, too, was suicide. 50% of eligible voters don't vote. In some locations, more than 50% don't vote. The majority of those non-voters are disaffected white men. Their wives and girlfriends find reasons to vote. Democrats offer them and every other sanctioned group a subsidy to vote. Meanwhile, many white men have grown content to live off the extra income their females earn due to Democrat policies. But ultimately, having a wife bring home the bacon is an insult to their masculinity. Democrats know that most white men resist a handout. The majority of them prefer to earn their way legitimately. Democrats had to convince their supporters that taking handouts was not an indication of failure. They targeted the rich. Democrats assert the rich illegitimately gained their wealth, wealth that should belong to Democrat supporters. Were it not for some unfair advantage, the rich would be dependent upon handouts too, they say. Remember when Obama said that the rich did not earn or build their wealth? Others helped them or they inherited their wealth. This Democrat mainstay conveniently excuses the failures of Democrat supporters and gave them a target for their frustrations, their greed, and envy. Democrats have worked hard to change our culture in many ways. Their work is ongoing. When I speak of Democrats, I do not mean all rank-and-file Democrats. The problem is the Democrat elites. They have grown rich claiming to serve the government. Most women would prefer not carrying the breadwinner responsibility, but they are realists and they know that the opportunities for white men have become fewer. Women also made a decision to contingently plan using the government as their surrogate husband or provider should their personal relationships go awry. This has had a long-term impact upon the family and divorce. Men need a rallying point for change. Even an obscure and meaningless promise to think about changing affirmative action policy is enough to secure men's votes. When Obama promised to heal race relations, he directly appealed to their prayers. Once elected, of course, Obama not only failed to heal race relations, he drove a bulldozer through them. Appointing Eric Holder and then Loretta Lynch as attorney generals who proved to be racists themselves. The Tea Party claimed to be purveyors of constitutional liberty, but even they brushed against the fringe of the issue. Early on, Democrats saw that the Tea Party might actually support the rights of white men, and they attacked the entire party as a bunch of racists. The Tea Party backed off and then tried to prove that they were not racists, something that can never be done. Proving a negative is impossible. There are genuine problems reaching non-voting white men. They are literally salt-of-the-earth types. They are men who primarily work with their hands and their backs. They know little about computers and cell technology, and they stopped paying attention to political ramblings long ago. When they were young, a few of them believed that a political party would help them. They learned it was a waste of time. They know they're on the outside, and nobody will take up the job to assure the civil rights of every citizen are not sacrificed to an antiquated and illegal rubric. The AA rubric has actually harmed more than the white men it was adopted to punish. The workplace has evolved over time due to these policies. It now concentrates as much on racial and sexual compliance as it does on productivity and efficiency. Few will even mention the plight of white men. They are forgotten in the generation of our time, the sons and grandsons of the greatest generation. Affirmative action policies that favor any sex or group over white men are purposeful. They are placed to discourage and defeat white men from becoming politically active and bar them from opportunity. Democrats know that these men have historically accomplished great things. They do not want them working alongside their sanctioned hires and exposing the disparity in ability and work ethic. No politician will champion their loss of freedom and equality. White men are treated the same as blacks were treated, prior to civil rights law enactment, and no politician or political party will even acknowledge the unequal and discriminatory treatment they face. Politicians, additionally, refuse to protect the meager jobs that are available now to white men. Construction was once the last respite for white men, because most were forced to form very small businesses that typically included them and perhaps a friend or relative. No more. Illegal aliens have taken many of those jobs. Politicians, even Republican politicians, refuse to enact laws that protect those jobs and enforce immigration policies. Democrats want open borders because they see illegal aliens as potential voters. And they know those votes would go to Democrats, the same people who would give them the right to vote. American business owners welcome these illegal aliens because they will work far cheaper than American citizens. With 50% of the eligible voting population available, you'd think politicians might want to tap into those votes. That they don't exposes the power of the word racist and the punishments. Anyone who actually reads the Constitution and suggests that it should be followed is a racist, and the fake news media and others will attack them for wanting to reestablish slavery. Jim Crow laws? We hear a lot about it. Jim Crow only lasted for 60 years, the same amount of time that affirmative action policies have existed. This is a strong argument to make, since AA policies deny white men their civil rights. Those who could benefit from AA policies have already benefited. The others who choose to live in a dependent state relying on Democrat handouts will remain there. In the end, inspiring the white men who do not vote is the only issue. Those votes would assure Democrats would never hold political office again, at least until they drop their current divisive policies of personal destruction and class welfare. That would be the most healthy outcome for our nation. Forcing Democrats to argue facts and embrace the traditions that made America once the envy of the world. I'm going to change direction from politics for the rest of today's commentary and focus on Mars, a planet that has drawn a lot of attention from Earth over the years. Few Americans understand the fixation on Mars, and today I'll explain why Mars is a great place to explore, but not a place to live. I credit Robert Walker of Science 20 for his help as I researched the Red Planet. Ever since I was a young boy, I've heard stories about Mars. Movies have been made about the Red Planet that featured little green men coming to Earth from there. Mars is a fascinating planet, the most like Earth of all the planets in the solar system, and may help us to understand much about the origins of life on Earth. But though it was quite Earth-like in its first few hundred million years, it is not at all like Earth now. Earth remains by far the most habitable place in our solar system. The most inhospitable places on Earth, such as Antarctica, even in the depths of winter and at the center of the continent, are far more hospitable than anywhere else in our solar system. Space colonies and the poles of the moon are both more easily habitable than Mars, and more easy to make self-sufficient. We see so many news reports about the possibility of humans colonizing Mars, and some people get very excited about that idea. But few, if any, of these stories mention the many drawbacks and downsides of human colonization. Mars is much colder than Antarctica. At the Curiosity site on Mars, typical nighttime temperatures are minus 94 degrees, and oft times it will drop to a minus 148 degrees. It is often cold enough on Mars for the water in the atmosphere to freeze out as dry ice. A human being couldn't survive those temperatures. The only reason that Mars isn't covered in ice is because it has so little water to turn into ice and the atmosphere is a near vacuum. It does get warmer at middays on Mars. Briefly, it can reach as warm as 34 degrees. So it's not freezing all the time. But the average temperature is similar to Antarctica. And Mars has high temperature swings between night and day. If we're looking for new land for humans to live in, there are many uninhabited areas on Earth that could be made hospitable with the levels of technology proposed for Mars. It makes much more sense to colonize Siberia or the Arizona or Sahara deserts than Mars. Mars does have an atmosphere, but it is so thin it would count as a laboratory vacuum on Earth. A human would need to put on a spacesuit to survive the low pressure on Mars, never mind the lack of oxygen. The pressure is so low, your saliva and the moisture coating the interior of your lungs would boil. A leak in your spacesuit would kill you instantly. Every Martian summer, roughly every 2 Earth years, there is a high chance of global dust storms. Those can last for weeks, and light from the sun drops by over 99%. Artificial light would be needed on Mars to grow plants. Solar power won't work, and the dust is potentially hazardous for humans, and you could not see far if traveling on Mars. Though the winds are not hazardous, the dust is as fine as talcum powder or cigarette smoke. And the atmosphere during the dust storms is a near vacuum. The strongest winds would barely move an autumn leaf. As a minor point, the dust itself may be hazardous to humans, not as much as asbestos, but enough to be of concern. It is almost inevitable that a colony on Mars would eventually contaminate the planet with Earth microorganisms. You see, a human being is host to about 100 trillion microorganisms in 10,000 different species. A habitat would have many other microorganisms, too, in the food and in the soil. Other supplies are floating in the air. The contamination could also affect your water supply. Spacesuits also leak air constantly through the flexible bearings in the joints. Another way for microbes to escape to the surface. And what if an astronaut has an accident on the surface of Mars, which breaches the suit? Or indeed, the spaceship itself has a hard landing and crashes on Mars with the contents strewn about the surface. After an accident like that, it might well be impossible to reverse contamination of Mars with Earth life. As microbes embedded in dust grains are protected from UV light, and can be spread anywhere on Mars in the global storms. What it amounts to is that containing contamination, we would need to land a biohazard laboratory on Mars with the crew and all of its contents as the biohazard to be contained and kept away from the surface of Mars. We do not have the technology to do that yet at a reasonable cost. There is also the possibility of life already on Mars. Some scientists think there may be life on the surface of Mars, even now in the harsh conditions there, but not life as we envision it. If so, there is the remote possibility that it might be hazardous to humans. It could be like Legionnaire's disease, which we are not immune to. Some believe that there are lots of resources on Mars, but mining on Mars would be hard to do, as hard as in space. You'd still need to use spacesuits because of the vacuum conditions. And however much you can make from native Mars materials, at least at present levels of technology, many components and replacement parts would have to come from Earth. None of our rovers on Mars have lasted very long, except for Opportunity, which has been active since 2004. Its sister rover, Spirit, stopped working in 2010. Human habitats presumably would be rated to last longer than that, yet the habitats would be extremely complex technologically. Things would go wrong eventually, and you would need parts from Earth. It's highly unlikely that you could really supply all the food needed by plants grown on Mars. And if you were able to do that, sometimes crop failures would surely occur, especially early on. Again, this requires food to be supplied from Earth. Medicine would be needed, too, and other supplies that need high levels of technology. Space suits are also complex mechanisms that could fail, and the colony would surely be unable to make and maybe only able to do repairs for them. It's best to think of spacesuits as more like mini spaceships than aqualungs. A typical NASA spacesuit would cost about $2 million to build from scratch, not including design costs. It requires about 5,000 hours of work and would take someone who had all the necessary skills about 2.5 years to build, given supply of all the parts and materials needed. If this machinery breaks down and can't be quickly repaired, you die. There is no way a Mars colony could be totally self-sufficient in the near future, except for some game-changing technology. The landscape on Mars may seem quite stunning in some of the photos sent back to Earth, but these have been digitally enhanced with the white balance changed to help the geologists recognize rock types. To human eyes, Mars is a dull, reddish, gray, or brown. The sky is the same color, too. It would be hard to distinguish different colors, and everything looks pretty much the same. If you lived in a colony on Mars, you probably wouldn't get much chance to explore it directly for safety reasons and because it takes so long to put on your spacesuit. Mainly, you would just see the view from your window, whatever that is. You would soon tire of the dull gray landscape and skies. Life would be complicated. Accidents do happen. On Mars, an accident would be fatal if it results in damage to your spacesuit or habitat. Also, in a vacuum, you can die just because you forgot one step on the checklist while putting on your spacesuit, or because you get interested in what you're doing and forget to allow enough time to get back within your oxygen reserves. Or you could just get delayed. A sprained ankle on Mars might well kill you because you can't get back to your oxygen supply to top it off. Also, you could get caught in a solar storm. They could be deadly if you are far from the nearest shielded habitat or rover at the time. In the future, we may use robots for exploring most of the time rather than humans for safety reasons. There are high levels of cosmic radiation, and you would need to limit the amount of time you spend on or near the surface of Mars without protection from the cosmic radiation. Otherwise, there is the elevated chance of getting cancer. There's also the issue of low gravity on Mars. So far, it's not known whether humans can remain healthy long-term in the Mars gravity. The same is true for the Moon, but it's much easier to return sick astronauts from the Moon to Earth. Issues astronauts would encounter in zero-G gravity include bone loss. In zero gravity, it's about 1% per month. On Mars, muscles atrophy occurs at a rate of 5% per week to start with. Blood loss would be about 22% within a few days on Mars and could be a contributing part for heart atrophy. Many of these things clear up on return to Earth as a rule of thumb, but it takes a day to recover for every day that you were in orbit. Mars is 141.63 million miles from Earth. The distance ebbs and flows, but on average it takes from 150 to 300 days to reach Mars from Earth with today's technology. The question to ask yourself, would you like to live on Mars if it was colonized, given what you now know about the red planet? Would you like to take a couple of hours each day just to put on the spacesuit to venture outside, or chance an accident that would invade the spacesuit or the colony itself? Most Americans would pass on that great opportunity. We chafe at trying to drive to Grandma's house two states away. Try sitting in a space capsule for more than 6 months just to get to a planet with nothing on it but rocks and dirt. No 7-Eleven, no Chuck E. Cheese, and no bologna sandwiches. The good news is that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer would be more than 141 million miles away. I doubt you could hear Schumer, but Pelosi's screeching might just bleed over.